right. My name is Matt Williams. Good to be together. We're going to spend the next few weeks studying together around the quest for purity. So grab your notes and let's talk together. Let's think. I'm going to do most of the talking on this one and you'll do most of the listening, but we're going to process together. What's important is we'll do some teaching and then there'll be some time to go in your groups. I know depending on the campus, depending on whether you're watching online or you know what your work schedule is, whether it's morning or night, groups, you may have to miss that sometimes, but we want you to make it a priority because I'm going to download info, but then you're going to have a chance to unpack. What are the one or two things that God has for you? And don't try to get it all in one bite. That's why we record everything, so you can go back and work through it a couple times. So we're excited about that. So I'll teach, and then we'll go into some groups. Where this started, and some of you heard me say this because you've been through some of this before, but a dozen years ago or 10 years ago, I got on a plane one morning at GSP, flew to Connecticut, spent 3 days. I was invited to sit and be a part of a sex addict conference. These are high-powered counselors, about 10 of them working with about 50 men, and this is their last opportunity to get restored, get some healing before they lose something. Job, life, marriage, something, right? This is the big end for them. This has got to be a win. So I got to sit in that for 3 days and be an observer. And it was cold and dark and scary and confusing. And it took a little while to sort it out. But after I was there about a day and a half, it got clear to me that these men were not in a separate category from me. These men were on the same continuum as I was, but they were just they were a little farther down the road. That some of the things that I thought, some of the things that I felt, some of the things that I thought about doing, some of the decisions that I had made, they had made those same decisions and they just kept going. And I had been tempered, not sometimes because I made a decision to be tempered, but sometimes it was my environment. Sometimes it was my home life. Sometimes there were other things that had tempered me. But it got clear to me that we were not working with different kinds of people. We were the same kind of person, all with the same kind of potential for destruction. And so that was startling. I came back, I shared that with our elders, we did some research, and so we put together this curriculum, which made its way into our Sunday morning as a theology of sex, but it started right here, and it has proven to be helpful as an ongoing discussion for us. Let me say a few things, then we'll jump in, and I hope you have your notes. That the most simple, basic idea that will help you get around the bend on some things is that you and your wife are different. Is that men and women, or if you're single, men and women, they are different. They're not the same. There are some dramatic differences. And you're like, well, that's obvious. But it is obvious to you on one level, but it's entirely anathema in our culture. No one wants to believe that. And here's where it means something to us. Is that if you took a group of women away for the afternoon and monitored their conversation, and then they came to a worship service that night, there would be no change in the demeanor of their conversation or the content of their conversation. What they said in private with just the four or five of them is the same as the way that they would talk at church. But a man, when he's away playing golf, working, he knows when he comes to church, he's got to think and talk a different way. Because church world is different. And what I would say is that church world is a bit feminized. Is that the way we talk at church is the way women talk in private. The way we talk at church is not the way men talk in private. And so what happens when the culture thinks and talks one way, but you think, talk, and feel in another way, when you walk into that environment, it shuts you down. And so men do not feel at home in the church. They don't enjoy church in many respects. And what they get the feeling is that I don't belong here. And what I think about, particularly about sex, that does not belong in this environment, and there's nobody here that would know what I think and feel, and there's nobody here that would be able to help me navigate this. Nobody here gets that. As soon as you walk in, you feel differently. No one's to blame for all this. It's just a fact. And so the churches remain silent. As one man told me, I expressed to my wife my challenges, my concerns, my fears. I was frustrated about some things in our intimate relationship, and she said I was weird. And after she said that the 50th time, I decided to shut down. Because I didn't want to hear that I was weird anymore. Because for her, when she started hearing, here's how he thinks and feels, it just hurt him so badly, he just withdrew. He just shut down. Didn't know how to respond to it. Of course, then that begins to dismantle that relationship because as he shuts down, the energy goes away. And the church once again remains silent. And a lot of us come from backgrounds where we got to get caught up. We were not taught. We were left to the culture. So I asked my dad asked me one time, we're riding down the road. He said, hey, if you ever have any questions about sex, all that, you let me know. And I thought to myself, boy, I ain't got no questions about that. No, sir. Because I had Johnny Clark, who was 2 years older than I was, who lived down the street. He was my tutor. He was telling me what all them words meant. He was explaining body parts to me. I had a personal tutor. Kyle Suggs lived a couple neighborhoods away. He had a bag out in the woods that had some porn magazines in it. So you had to walk through the woods and trash bag, and there they were. And I was like, what in the world? Look at all that. There's more education. And then in eighth grade, we had a sex ed class. And Miss Roach would bring us in five at a time. And she'd explain things to us that were real weird hearing from a woman at that age. And then one day on the last class, she pulls out a banana and rolls a condom over it. And boy, I was like, what are we doing? We walked out of that meeting, and I said, boys, that was crazy. And David Murray goes, I know, and I'll never eat a banana again. Over. No, got to find another fruit. That's where we come from. We're going to have some courage. 10% of our men would say their sexuality, sexual temptation, is not a huge struggle. 10%. 30% of our men show signs of addiction when it comes to sexuality. 80% would say they struggle on a daily basis. This is outside our context now. 30% of pastors say that they used porn recently. 20% of pastors say they've had sexual contact with another woman other than their wife. And 12% have had intercourse with another woman. So, we're going to have some courage. We have to be willing to step forward, think, talk, act, be vulnerable. Because I have a ton at stake. I don't know how much you have at stake. I know you have a lot. I got a son. I got four daughters. I got a wife. And I got a job that if I fail morally, I get fired. Like if you're an accountant, you fail morally in some ways, you'll really get fired. Like everything I've worked for 20 years goes away, 25 years. So I got a lot at stake, and you do too. And you could name what yours is. And let me say this as we jump in, is that truth and kindness are not opposites to each other. In other words, we can speak the truth about what the real truth is and what God wants for us. And then we're going to realize that we come up short from that. And we can be kind, and it can still be a safe environment. So sometimes when we speak truth, it comes off as unkind. Sometimes when we're kind, it feels like we're compromising truth. We can be truthful, and we can be kind at the same time. All right? So we want to embrace both of those ideas. Grab your notes. Let's look at this first key. We're going to go to four keys this next 2 weeks. It'll be the foundation for everything we do. Here's the first key. The first key is authority. We are definitely starting on the surface. Okay, we are starting on the surface. We're going to work our way down to expose the way we think and the way we feel before we get to the heart of it. The first key is authority. Is that, am I autonomous in this area or am I under someone's authority? Being God's primarily. Every once in a while, I'll build a little bit of furniture. So a few weeks ago, I was building some furniture. I was building a table to put a TV on in my basement. And I got this old wood I took from it's an old fence. My son gathered it up, and so I've been saving it. So I built this table, and I got it in my workshop, and I got it all lined up. And I'm like, that thing here, this is straight. You're right there. I'm getting ready to pop it down with the gun, and I'm like, that's straight. I was like, well, I might want to check. So I grabbed the square. I put the square on it. It's out by a quarter inch. I was like, I don't know. So I line it up with the square. I stepped back. I was like, no, that's crooked. And I mean, I walked all around it. I was like, this is crooked. I mean, I can see it. So I put it back the way I like it, straight. Take the square, put the square back on it, line it back up with the square, crooked. I am in a competition with a piece of metal. It's 15 minutes out of my whole life arguing with this piece of square metal. Trying to determine who's right. Let's just say. That can't take 15 minutes. You got to come to terms with, I'm not in charge. I'm not the standard. I don't have this all worked out. And so the square, and so then sure enough, get it down in the basement, set it up. I was like, oh, yeah, it looks great. Square was right. Who knew? There's this ability to violate what you think and what you feel and to come under the authority of something else and trust in that authority that even though it doesn't seem right in the moment, it is right ultimately and it'll work out better if I can put myself underneath it. But there it is a painful process. 1 Thessalonians 4, a few things. He goes, for you know what commandments we gave you by the authority of the Lord Jesus. For this is the will of God, your sanctification, that is, that you would abstain from sexual immorality. Each of you would know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor, not in lustful passion, like the Gentiles who do not know God. Now, let's be clear on this first thing. We do have non-Christians who come to our church and come to Roundtable, and it's awesome. It's great. But this teaching is for Christians, so this is a great chance for you to look in and be like, what does God want for his people? Here we're seeing it. This is for believers. Sexual immorality, sexual experiences outside the marriage of a man and a woman, premarital sex, adultery, homosexuality, pornography, illicit contact, which means a physical interaction, even an emotional interaction with someone that you're not married to, sexual speech, all of that is a form of immorality. We'll dig into more detail on it later, but all of that, God has revealed himself, and he has said, this is not right. And here's what we got to get clear on too. The physical reality is one thing. And the mental, emotional reality is another thing. But they are both realities. There are distinctions between the two. But what underlies both of them is that God sees them as both are realities. What I do physically, my actions, but what happens in my mind, both of them, there are some differences. But they have a common bond that they do exist. So, to fill in that first one, have you acknowledged that God has revealed his will about sexual immorality? Have you acknowledged that God has revealed his will? Because though most of us would say, yeah, sure, we don't live like that. Most of us, by the way that we live, would say, I am my own man, I deserve this, this is what I want. And we have a list of reasons for why we do what we want. The second question, are you willing to be submissive to his will and bring your life under the authority, under his authority on a daily basis? Are you willing to be submissive to his will and bring your life under his authority on a daily basis? These are great questions for us. One of the things that we want to say is that we are defined and directed by Scripture. That we should be defined as a group of people that are under God's authority, and then we are directed to do as he commands. That is one aspect of who we are, is that he has created us. This is illustrated very powerfully in the contrast between Adam and Jesus. Adam finds himself in a perfect environment. Jesus finds himself in the most difficult environment. Adam has everything that he wants. Jesus has nothing that he needs. Adam is there and is seeing God's provision over and over. Jesus is in the wilderness, starved of his of provision. And so when you compare Adam's failure and Jesus' success when it comes to temptation, they are tempted by the same things in dramatically different environments. Adam has every reason to win. Jesus has every reason to lose. But we see that Adam loses and Jesus wins in this. So let me show you this comparison. Adam's core bent is his emotion. By emotion, I mean what he thinks, what he feels, what he sees, what he can reason. He is responding to himself. You get that? He is responding to himself. He remains silent with his wife. He disbelieves or distrusts. That leads to disobedience, which brings judgment. Jesus in the wilderness, his core bent is truth. He's hungry. He deserves better than this. But God has said, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And here's the thing, they're almost arbitrary. Almost, in our sense, they would be arbitrary acts of obedience. He speaks proactively. He does not let this overwhelm him. He trusts, which leads to obedience, which brings about blessing. And this is what's important here, is that we underestimate how much of our obedience is rooted in our emotion. What I think, what I feel, what I deserve, what I want, we dramatically underestimate our emotions, probably because we're men. Like, I used to think I had one emotion, anger. Biggie's like, what's wrong with you? I'm mad. And I didn't realize, it's like I turned 40, I was like, oh, no, wait, that's not mad, that's sad. That's disappointed. And I didn't realize I had other emotions. It's fascinating. But we are obeying things that we are not completely aware of. When are you most tempted? So like, I'm most tempted when Vicky and I are not getting along. When I feel disrespected or dismissed by her, then I start craving respect from somebody somewhere, somehow. I want some affirmation somewhere. I worked with a guy years ago who was in medical school. When he got tired, when he got to the point of exhaustion, he came loose. For some, it's when they're bored, when they're angry. For some, it's when they're successful. Under the pressure, when they're losing money, they're godly. As soon as you turn the corner, things start going well for them, they get loose. It turns chaos for them. It raises questions of, is God good? Am I under His authority? What actually drives me? What idols do I leverage to survive? And sexuality becomes one of the highest ones. I'm going to use this to numb out. I'm going to use this to make me feel good. I'm going to use this to escape. I'm going to use this for affirmation. So we ask the question, who's in charge? The issue of authority. Second key is integrity. The idea of integrity to bring together, to make one. You might want to give me some time on this clock and then I'll know where I am. The second key is integrity. To integrate, to take things that are disparate and bring them together. Just things that are in different categories, to bring them all underneath one roof, under one authority. For us, in this context, it is to take the thing that is outside and the thing that is inside and make them one. That I don't have two lives. I don't have one life over here, one life over there. One life on the outside, one life on the inside. So multiple lives. It was just a few years ago, I had my first opportunity to work with, for an uneducated, unskilled layman in counseling, a sociopath. And when the world fell apart around here, and I'm talking to him, and I was like, you were lying the whole time. Like, I'm good at that. I'm good at discerning all that. How do I not know that you've been lying? And as we unpacked it for a while, here's the deal. In some sense, he wasn't lying. Because when he was with us, this is who he was. When he was over there, he was not this at all. He was that. So if you said, hey, you feel like this, you think, no, because that person feels that way. This is the person you're talking to. Almost a complete break in who he was, depending on what room he was in. Just this fissure, just this pulling apart. And so it was almost like when he was lying to you, he wasn't really lying because he was being true to the person he was putting in front of you. It's very weird. My mind could barely get around it. That is the most extreme case of what we do not want to be. We want to be integrated, one person all the time. I'll admit to you, being one person all the time brings some chaos into your life. Because not everybody wants to hear what you think and feel or deal with the real you. And there's some ways to temper all that. But it being one person all the time can complicate things. Leviticus 20. This is just interesting backdrop for us. If there's a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. Now, we could talk about the physical consequences of immorality. We could talk about the social and the example that it sets for the community and why this person has to die. But at the end of the day, God created marriage to reflect the relationship that he has with his people, and he did not want it dishonored or corrupted. So the marriage is important in and of itself, but it's actually not as important as what it embodies and symbolizes of who God is and the kind of love he has for his people. In the Old Testament context, this person's going to die. And so the idea of who am I honoring? Is everything about me, my sexuality, my life, my marriage, my sexual relationship, is all of that for me? Or is it reflective, tied to, connected to the one who created me? Is it just me, or is it something bigger than who I am? Because it feels like it's just me. And for a long time, I'm just trying, how do I survive? This, my sexual relationships, my sexual life, that's all about me. Not keyed to anything else. So to complicate things further, to avoid the physical act of adultery does not mean that we have actually avoided sin. Matthew 5. The physical act, it's not so simple. Jesus says this in Matthew 5, 27. You have heard it was said, you should not commit adultery. Like, yeah, we just heard that. We just read it. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. Like, oh, great. Someone's throwing stones at me right now. Now, these are not exactly the same, and the consequences are not the same, but he says the essence is the same in a number of ways. So here's part of the essence of that, is that the root of adultery and lust is that I want something that's not mine, and I'm wanting to take it, and willing to take it. Is that I want something that's not mine, and I'm willing to take it, either physically or mentally and emotionally. I want it, it's not mine, I'm willing to take it. That is the root commonality. The immoral man, once again, we're just looking on the surface and we're looking at a few aspects before we continue to dive down. The immoral man lives like a thief, selfishly bringing death instead of life. The immoral man lives like a thief, selfishly bringing death instead of life. So let me give you some examples about stealing. This is one way to look at it, okay? This is not the way, it's just one way to look at it. In the man who is lusting, desiring outside the bounds, he steals from another man. He looks at another man's wife, and he is stealing from that man because God has given that woman to that man. He didn't give that woman to you. So you're going outside, you're stealing something. It's lack of integrity. He steals from God because, let's say she's single, she's completely God's. So you're stealing from God. And if she's married, then God has sanctioned the relationship that she's in. So, and he still oversees that. So you're still stealing from God. You're stealing from the woman. Is that she has not decided to give herself to you, but you have decided that you will take it. She has not made a decision to give herself to you, but you've decided that you will take that. And then he steals from his own wife, whether future or current. Because the energy that you drain away from your wife and from your marriage was given to you by God to be an intimacy builder. And when that gets drained away and misdirected to someone else, then that energy is not present in your relationship, and all you're left with is the feminine side of intimacy, which is great and created by God, but it is not being matched by masculine intimacy to create the real heat that needs to be created there. So that's being drained away, diverted away, and so now you have kind of half of a relationship over here. So you're stealing from your own relationship. So here's the question for this to end integrity. Am I characterized by integrity? I mean, we all fail. We all fall. I mean, and you go through difficult seasons. We get all that. But what am I characterized by? What is the predominant theme? How does it normally go with me? And remember, right now we're not solving problems. We're just doing diagnostics right now. We're just diagnosing where we are. We're not solving anything. What am I characterized by? Am I characterized by integrity, or am I characterized by division? Two worlds. Am I characterized by integrity, or am I characterized by division? Let me give you some consequences. As we're asking hard questions for these first two weeks, let me give you some consequences. Some of this would be obvious, some of it maybe not so obvious. The immoral life, whether physical, mental, emotional, in whatever capacity, since they are unique, the physical and the mental, they are unique, but they are realities, and there are consequences to that. So what are some of those consequences? The first one is this, is that an immoral life, whether mental, physical, emotional, it causes decay in your soul. And God promised this. Paul writes it in Romans. He's like, the wages of sin is death. Now, that ultimate death where we stand judged before God. But even in micro ways, sin it just brings death. It's just what it does. Right? It's its nature. It's what it brings to the moment. It always brings death. And so you're causing your soul to die. But the irony of it is that we're more weak than we are evil, most of us. So the irony is a lot of us are using expressions of sexuality outside of God's design, not because we're so evil, but we're just trying to survive. Just trying to survive, man. Just trying to make it. Just trying to get by. We're just trying to survive. Which is the great irony, is that you're trying to give yourself life and you're pouring death into your own soul. So thirsty, so I think I'll drink some salt water. That's what we're doing. I'm so thirsty. I'm so hungry. But I'm eating bread with mold on it, and I am drinking salt water. There's nothing about what I'm doing that's actually getting me down the road to a better place. It's actually taking me to a darker place. Second one is that it hurts our relationship with God. The ability to commune with Him, worship Him, fellowship with Him. It's why so many of our men, I'm not picking on other churches, I'll just talk about Grace Church. So many of our men just do not enjoy church. They're like, I know I'm not good, but can I just avoid being a hypocrite? If I stay home and watch NFL, at least I'm not being a hypocrite. But if I go sit in there, listen to some dude talks too long, and then sing all these songs about stuff that I'm not really living, it just is torturing to the soul. So we have a lot of guys who are really struggling because they just feel, oh, I'm bound by this. Hurts your relationship with your wife, present or future, because, like I said, the energy is drained away, which creates more distance in the relationship. The distance in the relationship makes you more disillusioned and frustrated and craving something, so you go further outside to get some more, which creates a greater void in your relationship, which creates more wounds, more disillusionment, more distance, so that drives you farther away, which depletes the relationship even more, which makes it even more void. I mean, you can see how it just down spirals on itself. The fourth one, hurts your ability to relate to other women because you've been objectifying them, you've been using them, and now you're having to interact with them at work or wherever in, as if they were humans. It just complicates your soul. And then you have daughters. And you're like, and so for a bunch of us 15 years ago, we started having daughters who were like, okay, this complicates everything. These are people. Did you know women were people? Good night. Who told us? When you get daughters, it starts clearing all that up for you. The fifth idea. It creates a physical dependency. Is that sexual activity releases chemicals in your brain. God created all that. Meant to be enjoyed, not to be used for survival. When they are used for survival, you become addicted, enslaved. Right? I'm not trying to use those words interchangeably. I'm giving you different ways of thinking about it, okay? You can become totally dependent on that kind of energy. The sixth one. There's a loss of quality of life. Anything that enslaves you dominates your life. It begins to drain your life away, your finances. It costs you time, your thoughts, your habits, which leads to a place of isolation and addiction. And we'll talk about that in a few weeks. What does it mean when we get down into a place of isolation or addiction? And a bunch of our men are. A lot of us are on the edge and don't know. We don't have enough categories to be like, okay, so that's real healthy and that's completely destroyed. And I am right here on the edge. This is a critical time for me. We need to help with that. And then the last one, physical consequences, STDs, AIDS, pregnancy outside of a healthy relationship that God has for you. I mean, that's pretty obvious. But those are some of the consequences. Last idea, Romans 6. There's some decisions that we have to make. There's big decisions. There's little decisions that we have to make. And this is, we could not plumb the depths of the theological side of this, but here we go. Verse 8. Because now if we have died with Christ, we believe that we shall also live with Him, knowing, this is the point, knowing that Christ, having been raised from the dead, is never going to die again. So He died and then raised to new life. Death no longer has master, is no longer master over Him. So He has conquered death. For if the death that He died to sin once for all, but the life that He lives to God. Now, there is this huge theological issue in what Jesus did for us when He died on the cross to pay for our sins, take sin off of us, put righteousness on us. And He is saying, and so that He has given all this theological background. It's really important. But for our purposes, what we're going to take away because of verse 11 is that in another sense, Jesus said this. His life says this to us. Is that death comes before life. This life can't happen without this death. Okay, there's way more going on. But I'm saying for what we are doing right here is that death comes before life. Cannot have this kind of life without this kind of death. And that's why He says in verse 11, even so, as powerful as all the theology is, he says in this, even so, consider yourselves to be dead to sin. In other words, if you want to live a victorious Christian life, you want to be able to overcome some of this, you want to be able to put distance between you and this, a death has to happen first. Now, there is a first death and there's ongoing death. So that don't think, oh, I'm going to make a big decision, and then boom, good, I'm clean, clear, in the free, right? It is, there's some big decisions that have to be made, and then there's millions of small decisions after that that make sense. He goes, even so, consider yourselves to be dead, but alive to Christ. He goes, this kind of death has to happen, so this kind of life can happen. So the word consider means to decide. You have to decide. And this makes sense in the world you live in, is that you have to die to everything so you can live to one thing. You have to die to every woman so you can live to one woman in marriage. You have to die to all the other work and jobs so you can focus on your job. You have to die to all the other hobbies so you can have this one hobby. You have to die to all the other children in the world so you can raise your children. I mean, this is a simple idea that death comes before life. Because you cannot have two kings. The definition of two kings is not a king. This one rules today, that one rules tomorrow. That's the opposite definition of a king. A king just rules. He doesn't have to share with anybody. And so you got to die to one king so that you can live to another king. And that makes sense in this moment, but most of us have not thought in those terms that this was about rulership, kingship. I need to be a servant, and I don't actually have a right to express myself in the way that I've been doing it. The way I've been living shows that I am autonomous in my thinking, not subservient to someone else. That I've not given over rulership rights to someone else. Verse 12. Therefore, do not let sin what? Rule. Rule or reign. Do not let it reign. He is using kingly and worship kinds of metaphors. Do not let sin reign in your mortal body that you should obey its lust. He goes, you need to die to that. And do not go on presenting the idea of worship. Come to the temple, present yourself for worship. You present a gift for worship. Do not go on presenting the members of your body for sin. You should die to that, but present an act of worship. Present yourselves to God as those alive from the dead, your members as instruments of his righteousness. There's a big decision that needs to be made that says, oh, wait, I wasn't clear on this. This is not my life. I gotta come up underneath God. I gotta present myself to him. There's this big decision that says, I'm not in charge of me. He's in charge of me. But then there's a million small decisions where you get to say that ongoing all the time, continue to reaffirm that idea. A decision to not let sexual sin rule my life and to give my body to God. That's the kind of decision that we have to make. That is not all that we have to do, but that is part of what we have to do. Because here's what a Christian is. A Christian is a person who realized that they were doomed. They were under God's judgment. There was no hope for them. They had to come to him for mercy. He poured out his son's life to pay for their sins, and so they've trusted in him by faith, and when that happens, the Spirit of God comes to live inside them. And so there's been an exchange. They've now been given a new life and a new heart, and the old life has been taken away, and they've been given new desires. Now, some of our folks will say, I don't have any new desires. That may be because you're not a Christian, which is fine. It's helpful to know that. Because you may think, well, I always thought I was a Christian, but I never had any new desires. Well, it raises a good question. Maybe I'm not a Christian. Okay? And you go, was that a bad thing? No, that's a good thing to get clarity about where you are. And then you make a real decision about what you want to do. And then for some of us, like, I know I'm a Christian, but I don't feel like I have any new desires because a lot of us have continued to choose to present our bodies as an act of worship to something. And we have not realized that God was calling us to worship him with our bodies. Because here's what we've been doing. Get this. We've been praying that God would take away this desire. That's what we've been doing. God, you don't want me to feel this way. You don't want me to do that. I'm just praying you take it away. Let me ask you, how's that working? It's not working at all. You don't know anybody that's worked for. God, take away this temptation. Take away this. You know why it doesn't work? The same reason it didn't work in Corinth. God, please take away the temple of Aphrodite so I won't go worship there anymore. God's like, what? Does that make any sense? I could take it away, But then you'll just go over to Artemis, or you'll go find it. Where would I put Aphrodite? Somewhere else. You go find her somewhere else. Or you'll be like, I can't find her. I'll go worship him. I'll go worship the mountain. I'll go worship the tree. I'll go worship the snake. God's like, what? That didn't help anything for me to take that away from you. God's like, what am I taking away? I can't take it away. It's yours. This is yours. Taking away the temple of Aphrodite doesn't help anything, because the desire that's in your heart, that's your worship. And God's saying, you want me to take away the fact that you keep choosing to worship something else besides me? In this sense, it's the penis, it is the body parts, it is the desires that you have, it's the pornography, it's the other woman that you're so attracted to because your wife's such a loser now and you found someone better. He says, you want me to take that away? There's other women out there. What is it you want me to take away? You choose to present yourself as an act of worship, because you are the king who gets to make your own decisions about what you do. So you present yourself for worship anytime you want to. And God says, I'm telling you that that is death. You need to come under my authority and worship what I tell you to worship. God says, my spirit can give you new desires, but you are choosing what you worship. And so that's the rub for us. We're asking God to do something for us, and God's like, I'm sorry, what is it you want me to do? Doesn't make any sense. So we got to deal with our own. So these are our desires that we have to investigate. And we got to ask for God's mercy and his grace to open us up. But we got to start making some tough decisions about what I do in the next 30 minutes. What will I do Saturday night when my family's gone? We got to make decisions about all that. That's our decision to make. We got to consider ourselves dead to that life. Go in a different direction. So it raises some questions about who's my king. Is Jesus my king and I'm worshiping him? Or is God my golden ticket to heaven and the socially acceptable thing to do? So I have not seen that my relationship with Christ is informing everything about my life, and all of my life should be under his authority. That's a question we gotta work with. If you're not a Christian, you've not trusted in Christ, you don't have a new heart, then what I would ask you to do is take a little bit of time. Process this the next 2 weeks. Just take some time and process it and begin to ask some questions. And we'd love to help you think through it and be like, okay, this is how God puts new life into you and new desires and a new heart. The decision that we have to make to begin to move away from sexual sin, it will raise all kinds of issues. Let me just say, let's just be clear about this. Things do not get better soon. For most of us, the decisions that you have to make to begin to surrender your life to Christ and follow him, things are going to get worse. The short run is worse, not better. I am not telling you, hey, make some good decisions. You're going to feel great about that. You're going to feel horrible. Because you have been worshiping something, begging it for life, feeding on it as if it was giving you life. And then when that gets cut off, you're going to feel like you're dying. And the truth is, you are dying. But death always feels bad, but death always comes before new life. Jesus' death doesn't feel good either. No death feels good. So for some of us, you're entangled in a relationship, you're connected emotionally or chemically to what you are doing, and to cut that off becomes very, very difficult. We'll talk more about that later. Let me pray, and then you'll go to groups. You have some questions in your notes. Father, thank you for a chance to talk, think, discuss, work through some big ideas. For each of our men, as they hear these words, there's one or two things that need to be important to them. All of this cannot be important. So give them the one or two things that become clear. This is where I need to go to work. And for the things that I have said that reflect what you think and what you feel that honor you, would you cause those to hold tight and to stick in people's minds and to work your gospel into us, to open us up to the need for the gospel, for the news about Jesus, that we have a need for that. And then for those things that do not reflect or honor you, you'd let those things fall away and they just be blown away, not to be remembered. And so we ask that you would move among us now. Help us to honor you and glorify you in Jesus' name. Amen.